So for our second talk of the afternoon, I'm delighted to introduce Jack Milner from Stony Brook, who's going to tell us about the boundaries of Picker College.
Is the microphone working?
No.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here again. I think it was almost 40 years ago that Bill Thurston introduced me to the theory of dynamical systems. He'd gotten interested himself by talking to Robert May, who's a biologist studying insect populations. And May had pointed out, had described a mathematical model which would predict chaotic variations in insect populations from year to year. And his model just involved iteration of what we now call a unimodal map, which is a map something like that. Here, this is the insect population, and that's the change from year to year. So Bill got very interested in this idea of a relation between biology and dynamics of maps of the interval, and proposed that the dynamics of such a family of of maps as you vary the height really doesn't depend on the shape of the curve. It's the same whether you look at the sine x or x times 1 minus x or any reasonable family of unimodal maps. Well, he explained this to me, and I was very dubious. I didn't believe it could possibly be true, so I set to work trying to construct a counterexample. But after a while, I had to give up and listen to Bill. And this was a very valuable lesson, which since I was rather stubborn, it took a long time to sink in. But the lesson was that if Bill made a mathematical remark which sounded absurd, that never mind, he was right. This was many years ago, and the theory of maps of the interval has been developed a great deal over the years in between. So I thought the theory was more or less exhausted, but a few years ago, Bill introduced some new questions, new ideas, got some new fascinating results. I won't talk about that, but you can hear more about it later in the week from Tan Lei and from Kurt McMullen. Well, let me get on with my own talk and see if this backwards. Okay. So I want to talk about hyperbolic components and their boundaries, the definitions in a moment, but just a rough outline first. The interiors of hyperbolic components are well understood in their topological cells in a reasonable case. But the boundaries are rather mysterious, and very few of them are really understood. And the boundary, of course, is the interior of the hyperbolic component parameterizes maps that we understand very well. But the transition from this easy to understand behavior to more chaotic or mysterious behavior occurs as you cross the boundary. So there is some real interest in understanding just what is this boundary. So first, some definitions. I'll work with rational maps of degree n, where n is always at least 2. such, by definition, a rational map is a quotient of two polynomials which have no common factor. And if you just let this quotient correspond to the 2n plus 1 tuple of coefficients and take their ratios, you get a point in the projective space of dimension 2n plus 1. And the rational maps correspond to an open subset. And I'll work in a very general framework, namely take a completely arbitrary algebraic variety in the projective space and just intersect it with this open subset of rational maps. And I'll describe this as an algebraic family of rational maps. Now, the definition is that a rational map is hyperbolic if the orbit of every critical point converges towards an attracting cycle. Now, Fatou and Julia showed us something like 100 years ago that if you want to understand holomorphic dynamics in one complex variable, you must follow the orbits of the critical points. And they showed that whenever you have an attracting cycle, that is an attracting periodic orbit, there must be at least one critical point which is attracted to it. Or I'll say briefly, there's a critical point and its attracting basin. Now, the hyperbolicity is an open condition so that we, in any family, the hyperbolic maps form an open set. And any connected component of this set, I'll call a hyperbolic component in that particular family. Now another definition. In general, two points of a dynamical system are called, belong to the same grand orbit if their forward orbits intersect. Or I'll express this by saying the two points are grand orbit equivalent. So now I can state a rather easy but general theorem. Suppose we have such a hyperbolic component, and suppose that the maps in it have the following property. The basin of every attracting cycle, there's exactly one grand orbit equivalence class of critical points. There's always at least one by Fatou and Julia, so the condition is there shouldn't be more than one. Then, under these conditions, the theorem is that the closure of H is a semi-algebraic set. The boundary of H is a semi-algebraic set. H itself is a semi-algebraic set. I'll give a precise definition of what this means, but roughly it means that a set defined by real polynomial inequalities. So that's the easy part of the subject. I'll prove this and then try to go on describe what I believe happens in more general cases. But the basic philosophy is that if there's only one, essentially only one critical orbit converging to an attracting cycle, then it behaves very stably. But if there's more than one unrelated critical point converging to the same cycle, then there can be all sorts of confusion between the two and complicated boundary behavior. Well, let me give some examples. This is, well, a family, the formula I've written down. I'm looking at, this is a picture in the A parameter plane. And it's sort of hard to see detail here. So here's a blow up of a region in, let's see, is this, well, I don't see the pointer there. Let's see if I can use the mouse. So it's does that show up on the screen? Around this region, I've blown it up in the lower picture. Well, it's not very easy to see, is it? Okay, well, this is a family of map which has two critical points independent of A, namely 0 and infinity. And 0 always maps to infinity. Well, that's pretty evident. So what this means is that every map in this family has only one critical grand orbit. because the orbit of zero and the orbit of infinity eventually intersect. So only one up to, only one up to grand orbit equivalence. So it follows that every map, every hyperbolic component here has semi-algebraic boundary. Now, usually in studying rational maps, one has to distinguish between the easy case when the Julia set is connected and the messy case when the Julia set is disconnected. But in this, with this hypothesis, it doesn't matter. In this particular example, you have a teardrop shape enclosing the maps with connected Julia set, and the complement is maps with disconnected Julia set. But in both cases, the orbit is a smooth curve, except for a few possible cusp points.
So in this picture, which ones are hyperbolic?
The light-colored ones are hyperbolic. The black is the non-hyperbolic ones. So you have these colored oases of hyperbolic, made of collections of hyperbolic components.
Could you please repeat the question?
So I think in this example it's probably true that the non-hyperbolic points have positive measure, but I don't remember exactly. But in any case, you can see that the outer region certainly has a boundary which is smooth except for that cusp point. Another one. This one works. Okay, I'm blowing up that region. And so you can see this is a hyperbolic component with a smooth boundary. This has one cusp. Here's one with two cusps. Here's one with three cusps. And presumably they can have an arbitrarily large number of cusps, but the theorem is that they're all semi-algebraic. Well, here's another example. This is again a family of quadratic rational maps, and again zero maps to infinity, but in this case infinity maps to zero. So, and zero is a critical point, but infinity is not. So we always have a period 2 orbit, but there's one other critical point. I think it's minus 2a. Oh, minus a half. I think that's wrong. I think it's minus 2a for this particular family. But in the other critical point eventually lands in this attracting cycle, super attracting cycle, whenever we're either in the blue region or the red region, the blue region or the yellow region. But on the other hand, if we're in the red regions, then you can see that these are made up of sets which look rather like Mandelbrot sets. Each red region is decomposed into hyperbolic components with smooth boundaries, smooth with maybe possibly one cusp. On the other hand, for the boundary of the outer blue region, you can see it's somewhat jagged. If you look at the if you look at this region, you see it's somewhat boundary. And in general, it's nothing looks too well. Topologically, they all seem to be simple, bounded by simple closed curves, but they're definitely fractal in most cases. So only the red regions are semi-algebraic, have semi-algebraic boundary. Well, let's make all this more precise. So first of all, I define a basic semi-algebraic set. It's just one that is the solution of a finite number of algebraic inequalities, and it's enough to stick to ones either of this form or of this form. And the R's and S's are supposed to be real polynomials, polynomials with real coefficients. And given pairs of such inequalities. For example, if r is greater than or equal to 0 and minus r is greater than or equal to 0, then we see that r is equal to 0. And similarly, by combining two of these, we can get inequalities of this form. So that's the definition of a basic semi-algebraic set. And then if we take any finite union of these, it's called a semi-algebraic set. And that's the complete definition. Another point. This is a definition for subsets of a real vector space. In the complex case, we just ignore the complex structure and think of Cn as a real vector space. We'll also want to talk about subsets of projective spaces, but they're covered by finitely many coordinate neighborhoods, and it's easy enough to extend the definition. So basic properties. And here, some of these are rather difficult theorems. I won't try to prove anything, but this is a reference which contains all of the properties I need. So the first one is easy. A finite union or intersection of semi-algebraic sets is semi-algebraic. That's an exercise. The complement of a semi-algebraic set is, again, a semi-algebraic set. That's, again, an exercise. But this is getting more difficult. Every semi-algebraic set has only finitely many connected components, and each one itself is a semi-algebraic set. The topological closure of a semi-algebraic set is, again, a semi-algebraic set. The image of a semi-algebraic set under projection is semi-algebraic. And every semi-algebraic set can be triangulated. So in particular, it's always locally connected. Well, the last four properties are serious theorems, and these are exactly, I think I will make use of every one of these properties in the following argument, which makes it a very easy argument since all of the hard work has been done for me. So, I first recall the statement, I have a hyperbolic component in some family of rational maps. It has the property that for each attracting cycle, there's only one grand orbit equivalence class of critical points converging to it, whose orbits converge to it. And we want to prove that these sets are all semi-algebraic, H itself, for example. So say we have M attracting cycles for maps in this hyperbolic component. Then, by definition, if it's hyperbolic, every critical point has to converge to a attracting cycle. So M must be at least one. And now I form a branch covering of the family F. This is F, remember, is an open algebraic variety, so it makes sense to talk about an algebraic branch covering. I look simply at all M plus one tuples consisting of a map F in the family and M points which satisfy two conditions. Each one should have period exactly PJ under the map, so that's where I better keep both of these things in my hands. So that's where these PJs come in. And the orbits of these M points must be disjoint. Well, it's an easy exercise to prove that this defines a semi-algebraic set. Okay. Now, in this semi-algebraic set I've just constructed, I look at an open subset consisting of points which satisfy M conditions. Namely, for each M, we have a periodic point of period, for each J, we have a periodic point of period P sub J. We look at the first derivative of the first return map, the P to the J, P sub J fold iterative of the map, and that first derivative is called the multiplier, and we want these multipliers to be all less than one in absolute value. And if I call the square of the of the multiplier. That's then a real polynomial in this algebraic variety we're looking at. And so this defines a semi-algebraic subset. So if this set is semi-algebraic, then by the general properties, every connected component of it is semi-algebraic. The image under projection from this branch covering down to F is semi-algebraic. And it's not hard to see that the image is a hyperbolic component in F. And furthermore, that any hyperbolic component in F having attracting cycles with these periods can be obtained in this way. So this completes the proof. I wish all of the theorems we wanted were that easy to prove. Okay, what happens when we don't have these conditions? So, well, I'm a little vague in the statement here. I'm supposing that there's an attracting cycle with two critical points in its orbit which are not related in any way. So I'll call them free critical points if they're totally unrelated, so that they can vary independently. And then the wild conjecture I would like to be true is that in this condition, the boundary is never locally connected. Well, so there are enormous numbers of examples where this would apply. There's not a single one where I know how to prove it or have any strong evidence that it's true, so I think I'm justified in calling it a wild conjecture. But what do I mean by free critical points? I certainly mean that there's no relation between them, so that they should be able to vary independently, so there should be two complex degrees of freedom. So I'm talking about a question which only makes sense if we're in a parameter space of complex dimension at least two. Now, unfortunately, I like to understand dynamics by making two-dimensional pictures, but real dimension two, complex dimension, is rather more formidable. But we can't just show a two-dimensional picture and draw any conclusion from it without a lot of extra argument. Well, so let me start with a sample family of complex dimension two. This is the family of cubic rational maps with a critical fixed point at infinity and another critical fixed point at the origin. So we've, cubic rational maps, there are essentially four degrees of freedom, since there are four critical points, and the number of critical points roughly describes the number of essentially distinct dynamical systems. So we've put on two conditions, that there's two critical fixed points, which brings the dimension down to two, but unfortunately still complex dimension two. And then in this family, I want to look at the main hyperbolic component. I'll just take the one centered at A equals B equals zero, and you can easily check that that is the rational map F of Z equals Z cubed, which is fairly familiar. So it has a circle as a Julia set separating zero from infinity, and if we vary within the hyperbolic component, then this circle will become a quasi-circle, but topologically it will remain the same. So the points in F are fairly easy to understand. But now comes the tricky part. I want to take a two-dimensional slice so I can make a picture, and I'll take a slice which is not defined by an complex algebraic equation. This is only a real algebraic equation, saying that B is equal to A conjugate. And here's a picture of a detail of the parameter plane, the A parameter plane, say, for maps satisfying this condition. The main hyperbolic component is the big component out here in white. And, well, the property of this is that in this real slice S, this hyperbolic component does not have locally connected boundary. This is work with Araceli Bonafont and Xavier Bouffe. And let's see, I can just show you a detail up in this region so you can see it a little better. Unfortunately, I'm sorry that the detail uses a different coloring system. So for example, this yellow region here corresponds to this blue region, but in any case, you can see a little better here that there are infinitely many fjords in the white region going off to infinity and converging down towards this smooth parabolic curve. So we have a topologist comb-like structure, and it follows that the boundary is not locally connected. Well, I'd like to conclude from this that the original boundary of the original four real dimensional component is not locally connected, but I don't know how to do that. If we wanted to make a proof from this, we could take two neighboring fjords here, or two very close fjords, there and there maybe, or better still, take two points on the opposite boundaries of a narrow fjord, and then try to prove that they can't be joined by a small path without crossing through the white. But for that, we would have to prove that there, in the four dimensions, so there's a whole three-dimensional plane of white points separating them. And I don't know how to prove that. So what we can do from this much information is prove at least that the boundary is not topologically tame, namely it's not locally contractible. Well, how does that follow? Let me give you an analogous example, the Sierpinski carpet. By definition, this is a start with a black carpet and then let a countably infinite family of moths loose on it, so you have a carpet with infinitely many moth holes, which are everywhere dense, and you get this object, which you can easily check is locally connected. On the other hand, if I center this in the complex plane, so that the origin is at the center and we can intersect it with the real axis, then although this set is locally connected, its intersection with the real axis is just the classical Cantor middle third set, and that is certainly not locally connected. Well, how can we proceed from that? If we take two points along the real axis, which are separated by one of these white boxes, they can't be joined along the real axis, but they can be joined, for example, by going a little up and around, going up. But if we can join them above, we can also take the complex conjugate and join them below. So we get a little loop around the white box, which can't be shrunk within the black region. And since these loops can be arbitrarily small, it follows easily that the black set is not locally connected. It's not locally contractible. It has a local fundamental group, if you like. And a similar argument applies here. If we take two opposite boundaries of a fjord, if we assume that the complement of H is connected in the four-dimensional region, we can join them by a path, and then there's a complex analytic involution changing AB to B bar A bar. So we can take the image of this loop and this path under the anti-holomorphic involution and get a little one-dimensional loop around this fjord. Well, we're in four dimensions, so that's not good enough. But suppose that this small loop bounds a small two-cell. Then again, we can take the image under the anti-holomorphic involution and get a embedded, or a, at least immersed, at least a singular image of a two-sphere surrounding this fjord. And now, even in four dimensions, if you have a line and a two-sphere surrounding it properly so that they link each other, then you can't shrink the two-sphere to a point without crossing the fjord. There's a rather amusing topological lemma that one needs here. Let me just express it in terms of the Riemann sphere. So if we have a mapping from the Riemann sphere to itself, which is odd, and it has zero and infinity as fixed points, then it follows that its degree is odd. In particular, its degree is non-zero. Yeah, I did, yes, thank you. This has nothing to do with complex analysis. It's just a simple way of describing the two-sphere for the purpose. This is a very elementary-looking statement in algebraic topology, but I don't know how to prove it purely in terms of classical algebraic topology. So maybe somebody else, I mean, I can prove it using methods of differential topology and a little work, but anyway, that's what's needed in order to prove that the two-sphere we get this way links the fjord. And if anybody has an idea of how to prove it easily, I'd be interested. Well, this discussion raises various questions that I don't know how to answer. Here's the picture you've just seen before, but repeated here. What happens in this gray region? What happens is that it's full of Hermann rings. That is, rational maps such that there's a topological annulus which is mapped to itself with a rational rotation number. And oh, here's a different image of showing the whole, if we take the whole A-plane and compress it into a disk, I think also identifying A with minus A, then we get a picture of the picture like this, where you can see the whole picture and the whole frame and the whole parameter plane in one finite region. The white region in the middle has the same really meaning as before, but now the points outside where they're full of Hermann rings are colored according to the rotation number of this Hermann ring. So as you go around, they vary from zero up to a half to one. Well, these Hermann rings all belong to the topological boundary of the white region. The proof is that any two of them are connected by a fjord in the are separated by a fjord in the white region, and one with a little work one can show that it's a limit point of points in various fjords. But as far as I know, none of these Hermann rings is accessible from the white region. I think it's probably possible to prove this in the two-dimensional slice, but the question I want to ask is what happens in the full four-dimensional, real four-dimensional space? Can one of these Hermann rings be accessible from a hyperbolic component? It's accessible in the sense that there's a path in the component converging towards it. And if there are inaccessible boundary points, would that imply non-local connectivity. Assertions like this are easy to settle in dimension 2, but I don't know what happens in dimension 4. So again, if anybody has ideas, I'd be glad to hear about them. Okay, so that's a rather complex example in C2. Let me describe the one example that I can more or less analyze accurately, but it's a simplified thing which doesn't quite fit into the general pattern I described earlier. Again, instead, it's a dynamical system which, instead of mapping the Riemann sphere to itself, maps a disjoint union of two copies of the complex numbers to itself. So I start with two copies of the complex numbers. I'll call them the Z plane and the W plane. And I take the standard formula for a quadratic map from the Z plane to the W plane, where the only parameter is the critical value, the image of the critical point. But then I take a second map, which takes the W plane to itself. And here I'll use a slightly different normal form so that we have a fixed point at the origin, and use the multiplier, the first derivative of f at that fixed point, as a parameter. So putting it all together, we have a two-parameter family of maps from this disjoint union to itself. And now I can talk about a hyperbolic component in this dynamical system. We have a complex one manifold mapped to it holomorphically to itself with two critical points. And we can look at all parameter pairs such that both critical orbits converge to the origin. Or in other words, for the second critical point to converge to the origin, we just need that the multiplier has absolute value less than 1. And in the first, we need a condition on the image of the critical value. So we started, although this is a two-parameter system, it really involves dynamics only in one copy of the complex plane, because all of the action takes place in the W plane. The only thing we need to know about the Z plane is where its critical point maps. So this gets to be a very classical picture in which we just have a quadratic map from a complex plane, the complex line, if you like, to itself, and we're given a point and want to know what it does under iteration of this map. This is a subject which has been thoroughly studied for the past 30 years, and I would have thought that about every question you could ask has been answered, but I don't know how to answer this one. Does this boundary have is the boundary of this hyperbolic component, is it simply connected? Well, let me work with the closure. So that is the set of all pairs such that now mu is less than or equal to 1, and such that V belongs to the filled Julia set of G sub mu. That means the union of all bounded orbits. So this is a still perfectly explicit problem. Now there are two cases to consider. If mu has absolute value strictly less than 1, then we're in a very well understood case. The filled Julia set then is just a topological disk bounded by a quasi-circle with a critical point inside and the pointed infinity outside. And this quasi-circle varies continuously as you vary mu, but you get a topological picture which is very easy to understand. On the other hand, if you look at mu on the boundary, then things are much more difficult. As mu varies around the unit circle, we can look at what happens to the filled Julia set, but it jumps around very wildly. Here's the simplest case. If mu is a root of unity, then we get a parabolic case, which is very well understood. But for almost every choice of mu, in the sense of Lebesgue theory, we get a different picture with a Siegel disk. So in this particular picture, let's see, there's the critical point at the center of symmetry. Its orbit is this wiggly black line. The region inside the Wrigley-Bacallac curve is a sequel disk which maps diffeomorphically onto itself and is conjugate to conformally conjugate to a rotation through some fixed angle. So those are two of the better understood cases. Finally, there's what happens for a generic choice of mu, that is for all mu in a countable intersection of dense subsets. In that case, the set is definitely not locally connected. It has no interior, and it's, I don't know how to draw any reasonable picture of it. So these are the things we have to fit together to try to construct a proof that the boundary is not locally connected. And as we saw from the Sierpinski carpet example, just knowing that one particular part of the boundary is not locally connected doesn't help. It doesn't prove anything. So what I want to work with is the fundamental discontinuity in studying such things. So here I'm starting with the case mu equal to 1. So we have a map with a parabolic fixed point at the origin. The critical point, as usual, is at the center of symmetry, and the critical orbit just converges to this parabolic point. So this is looks like a pretty easy example to understand. And now suppose we just change mu a tiny bit. So here I'm replacing 1 by moving a 1/100th of a radian around the unit circle. And suddenly we get a much bigger, everything jumps in. And well, I can rather try to explain what happens by taking a, so the statement I'm making is that if we start with a parabolic map, then under an arbitrarily small perturbation, the basin of infinity may explode inwards, get bigger. The Julia set, the boundary of that basin of infinity, may also jump in. Well, has to also jump in. So to explain this, we're looking, starting with a point where we have just one fixed point, a double fixed point where we can think of this algebraically as two fixed points which have come together. So under a slight perturbation, this single parabolic fixed point will split up into two fixed points, which may, they may both be repelling. One may be repelling, one may be attracting, and so on. In this particular case, here's the repelling fixed point. It's the center of this spiral. And there's an indifferent fixed point with absolute value 1, or in fact, there's the multiplier of the fixed point up here somewhere. And what happens as mu converges to 1 is that these two fixed points squeeze together so that there gets to be a more and more narrow gate that orbits have to go through. So if you take an orbit, a point here, say, then its orbit will travel there and then travel very slowly through this gate to get out there, and move rapidly, and then very slowly to escape. And as the gate closes, the time needed to get through gets longer and longer, so that in the limit, as mu goes to plus 1, all of the points out in this region here to here no longer can escape. And suddenly, this is the parabolic implosion I spoke of, in which all of this region suddenly becomes gray in the limit. Well, this behavior certainly doesn't look very conducive to local connectivity of the boundary, but what does it really imply? There's a foundational paper about this subject by Pierre Lavore, which unfortunately has never been published, but nonetheless, it's been at the center of research for some time. So it'll be convenient to use a slightly different normal form. So I'm modifying the parabolic map z goes to z plus z squared, and I'll just add a small constant term to it. And here I'll convenient to take eta very close to the positive real axis and close to zero. So you can compute the two fixed points, just setting this equal to z and solving solving the resulting equation. You find that the fixed points are plus or minus I eta. So if eta is close to the real axis, one will be close to the imaginary axis, and the other positive imaginary axis, and the other will be close to the negative imaginary axis. And the multipliers, you just take the derivative of that equation, evaluate it at plus or minus I eta, and you get this formula for the two multipliers. Okay, and now what Lavoie does is pass to the limit as eta goes to zero. So let me use the notation beta for the parabolic basin of the, or in other words, the interior of the cauliflower. So that's the set of all points attracted to non-trivially to zero. And now this is where the tricky bit comes in. We introduce a new parameterization by introducing this phase function, which has the reciprocal, is just proportional to the reciprocal of my parameter eta. So as eta goes to zero, this will go to infinity. Here's the theorem. Suppose we have a sequence of parameters eta j converging to zero in such a way that this phase converges to a limit. Well, it can't converge to a finite limit, but it converges to a limit modulo z. In other words, we can suppose that there are integers k sub j, so that sigma of eta j plus k sub j tends to a limit. And for this to happen, of course, k sub j has to go to infinity, plus infinity. So sigma, remember, is going to minus infinity. So under these hypotheses, the theorem is that this sequence of iterates, if you take f, the map f, which was just z squared plus z plus eta squared, and iterate it k sub j times, where the integer k is going to infinity, then it converges locally uniformly throughout the basin to a function, which I'll call Lavoie function, which is holomorphic and effectively computable. Now notice, I'm not just saying it's effectively computable because we can take this limit. This is a horrible limit. It goes very slowly, and the more terms we take, the harder it is to compute. So it would be totally impractical to just compute this by passing to this limit. But in fact, what he does is express the limit in terms of Fatou functions, which are classical and well-known, and get a simple computable formula. So notice we started it out with a two real dimensional parameter space and a two real dimensional dynamic space. When we pass to this limit, we still have a two real dimensional parameter space, but we have this sigma zero, what we're really concerned with is just its value modulo z. So we can think of it as an element of the cylinder, complex numbers modulo z. So here's a picture. I have two complex parameters here, so I have to fix one of them to get a two-dimensional picture. In this case, I'm fixing sigma zero, taking it equal to I pi. And here's a blow up of the region I'm interested in near the origin. These are pictures, this is a picture in the lower right-hand quadrant of the cauliflower, and this is a detail near zero in the cauliflower. Well, what does the color indicate? It's the value of the scape function, and when we have such a map from a smaller set to a larger one, there's just one meaningful definition of escape. It's the number of iterations we have to take for a point in beta to get out of beta. So the green region means that it has already escaped. The blue region means it escapes in one iteration of the Lavoisier function, which in terms of the original approximating quadratic maps means one passage through the gate. Red means that you need two iterations or two passages through the gate. So one passage will get you from red to blue, another from blue out to green, and so on. This is just a rather arbitrary color code. So escape function 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I ran out of colors, so I just reduced modulo 5. So this green region takes 5 iterations to get out to that green region. And this blue region takes 5 iterations to get out to this one. Well, let's see. Well, remember that the Lavoisier's parameter, the phase function, is a function works purely in the parameter space. So we can look on the right-hand disk where we're working, where our parameter varies over the mu varies over the unit disk, or the left-hand region where it varies over the upper half plane. And it's given by these formulas. So remember, sigma is minus pi over eta, and the upper fixed point has multiplier 1 plus 2i eta. So this is a Möbius transformation. This is a linear transformation, so it's also Möbius. So what we have is just a Möbius transformation. It must take something to the unit disk. The thing it takes to the unit disk is the half plane where the imaginary part of sigma is greater than or equal to pi. And so if we take the open half plane, it will map conformally onto the open unit disk. And as we go out to infinity, we'll converge to the to mu equals 1. Well, this picture will be important in what follows, so let me try to describe it more. So what happens if we start here and move to the left along a blue line? Well, that will move along a blue curve here, a circle tangent to the unit circle at mu equals 1, and so in particular we'll converge to mu equals 1. And if we jump by integer steps, so from sigma to sigma minus 1, sigma minus 2, and so on, then correspondingly we'll jump by steps to maps which are converging according to Lavoisier theorem. Well, remember that the escape function is a function of two complex variables, so it's a decoration in C2, or at least in the product of a cylinder with C. So I showed before pictures where we fixed sigma and let the dynamic variable Z vary. Now let me show you a picture where we fix Z0. Take a particular value, minus 0.02i, and let sigma vary over the cylinder. Well, this rectangle should go to infinity in the upward direction. At the bottom, we have the value, imaginary part of sigma is pi, and then it's increasing to plus infinity there. Here we have real part of sigma is 0, real part of sigma is 1, and the left and right boundaries should be identified. Or another way of saying it, you should imagine infinitely many copies of this rectangle going off to the left and right, sitting side by side. Now, in terms of this picture, if we start with a typical point in the gray region, that is in the main component, it's very easy to converge to draw a path going to mu equals 1. We just go straight to the left. or if we happen to be bad luck and start down in here, we just move up a little bit and then go straight to the left. So the question arises, can we do this for any gray point? Is this all that happens? Well, this was just a picture for one value of z0. So what we have to do is look at the corresponding situation for all possible values of z0 and see if we can find a counterexample. Let's see now. I need to use the mouse. If it's working, yes. Okay, here's going back to this picture. Here this is the z-plane, and I was looking at a special point, minus 0.02 times I, but more generally we can get a representative sequence of points just by starting here and moving up along the negative real axis towards zero. Back. And whoops, what happened? Okay. So this is a movie where we're varying z along the line along the negative axis up towards zero. And let me run it again. So the question is if we can find anywhere on this, well, this is very stubborn, let's see. If we see any place where there's a difficulty. Now, if we just stop at a general place, we'll find there's no problem. We can, wherever we are in the gray region, we can just go to the left. But if you look very carefully, you find that some places there are difficulties. And one of them is shown in this, dropped the wrong one, let's see. This is a picture near the beginning of that movie where we see here is a gray region which is not so easy to move across. And suppose we go ahead, here is a very bad example. So z is now minus 0.141 times I. Here I've drawn the thing to going a little bit below pi so that the imaginary part of sigma equals pi is in the is this dotted line in the center. Above this, one of the fixed points is attracting. Below this line, both fixed points are repelling. And let's now remember what we should really do is look, take infinitely many copies of this side by side so we can try to wander off to infinity. So here are four copies. What we can do is start, say, picking a point z in the gray region here. And then subtract 1, 2, 3, and keep going to the left. According to Lavoisier's theorem, the pictures we get will converge more and more closely this is actually a picture for the Lavoisier function. But if we look at the corresponding quadratic maps, as we move to the left, they look closer and closer to this. So if we go very far to the left, this will be an accurate picture of what's happening for the quadratic map. And now, if we look up here, look at this rectangle and consider its boundary. What happens on this boundary? Well, in the outer red part of the boundary, the orbit of the critical point is escaping to infinity. And that is an open condition, so it will be preserved under small perturbations. In the bottom region, both critical points are repelling. That's an open condition, so it will be preserved under small perturbations. So what have we done here? We've taken sigma zero and kept subtracting integers from it. And if we solve for the corresponding A to K, we get this formula, which is going to zero as K goes to plus infinity. And what we've found is that these corresponding quadratic functions converge to the Lavoisier map. But if we look at the boundary of R, and for every close to zero, every eta close to zero, then there's an obstruction to, we can't cross that boundary and stay within the red region, within the gray region. So there, for any z close to z0, we can't pass to the left without making some definite change in z. So this is a rather poor cartoon of the argument. I should explain here that the here the z, the mu axis is going to the right, and the z axis is going left, or rather the imaginary part of z. This is a, should be a four-dimensional graph, and I can only draw in two dimensions. But what we have here is a sequence of points. Remember, going to the left in the Lavoisier coordinate corresponds to converging to plus one. So we have a sequence of points converging to cross plus one, all with the same z coordinate equal to minus 1.41i, so that we can't get to the, stay within the gray region without jumping some definite distance in the z coordinate. So if we go down here, we can just go out straight to the right to the cauliflower, and there's no problem. But if we start here, any one of these points, we have to jump down before we can get out. And this gives us a typical topologist comb obstruction to local connectivity. So if you believe all of my computations, then we've proved that H bar is not locally connected. Now, I can't claim that this is a mathematical proof because it depends on some very delicate computations which haven't been checked. I could have made a mistake in the programming. I could have made a mistake in the approximation to the Fatou coordinates. So in order to make a proof out of this, one would have to do some very careful analysis. But it does strongly suggest that one can prove, at least in this simple case, that the closure is not locally connected. And it's my suspicion or belief that this special case will reflect what happens in much greater generality. And I've already run over time, I think, so thank you. The question is, the simplest example would be the main hyperbolic component for cubic polynomials. So that's a topological 4-cell. It would be the simplest example where my conjecture would predict non-local connectivity. Well, I don't know how to prove it. I hope it could be proved by this method, but you notice I needed a very detailed computation for one specific example. And since there are infinitely many examples that the conjecture applies to, it's hopeless to do that. One has to have a more conceptual proof.
But my question was if you had any experimental evidence for this.
No.
Anyone else?